Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Plunkett, along with co-host Melissa Treibwasser. Melissa, how are you tonight?
I am doing just fabulous. How are you doing?
I'm doing so great. You know, there was some pretty big news that went down this afternoon about TCU football, and I think we should probably talk about that tonight on this episode, don't you?
I feel like there might be some interest in what happened over at TCU this afternoon. So, yeah, that might be a good point to start off.
Oh, absolutely, I think there is. There's a good place to start right there with Gary Patterson announcing Kenny Hill as the starting quarterback for TCU football in 2016. It's an announcement that might not come as a total shock to a lot of people, but Patterson did say that Foster Sawyer really pushed Kenny for this starting job. But, you know, Melissa, I think most folks were just kind of expecting Kenny Hill to come in, and once he, you know, set out for a year, and once Boykin was gone, that he was just going to step in and be the starter. And it turned out that, you know, that was kind of the case.
You know, I think it's good that Patterson didn't just give him the keys right away. You know, obviously by having him enroll at Tarrant County College in the spring after he left A&M, before he even was able to come to TCU on campus, and then spending the year earning his stripes in practice and in a locker room with the guys, having to battle, and I don't know how much of that was wordplay. I mean, that's a Gary Patterson trademarked motivational technique. And how much of that really was just Foster made it hard to say, you know, Kenny Hill was the guy from day one. But, you know, for a guy who kind of has had some issues in the past and maybe, you know, walked around with a little bit of entitlement, I think that he probably really feels like he did earn this job. And hopefully that'll make it mean something special to him.
Yeah, I definitely think it will, because, you know, there's no way that Foster Sawyer just rolled over and let him have the starting spot. Mm-hmm. Sawyer's got a really good skill set. He's got a good arm. We saw it a little bit last year against Oklahoma. Granted, you know, he had some freshman nerves there and I guess was getting a little bit too much air under the ball. But he's got some good legs. He's got some good mobility. So it definitely wasn't something, like you said, that Kenny Hill could just walk in and take right away. He did have to work for it. And I think that's going to benefit TCU in the long run, because if you think back to 2 years ago when there was another Texas A&M transfer in the mix and Boykin fighting for the starting job, Patterson said that both guys really did benefit from that competition in the spring and especially in August getting ready for the regular season. And I think it's part of the reason we saw TCU come out so hot to start the season in 2014. Hopefully that, you know, that the same thing happens here in 2016 as well. But I do kind of want to get into Kenny Hill a little bit. We all know him pretty well. We know some of his escapades at Texas A&M really well, but let's go back and kind of learn a little bit more about the new TCU starting quarterback. What do you say?
Sounds good to me.
So Kenny Hill went to Carroll High School in Southlake, Texas. He was the Texas Gatorade Football Player of the Year in 2011, I do believe. And he threw that year for a little over 2,200 yards, actually almost 2,300 yards. He threw for 20 touchdowns. Rushed for almost 1,000 yards and rushed for 22 touchdowns. So for those of you counting, that's over 3,000 total yards of offense and 42 touchdowns when he was the Gatorade Football Player of the Year for the state of Texas. He won a state championship with South Lake Carroll in 2011. I guess Gatorade Football Player of the Year was 2010, state championship in 2011. Eventually decided as a member of the class of 2013, he was a four-star quarterback on both Scout and Rivals, to join the Texas A&M Fighting Aggies, which is a choice that many, many high school kids make and many, many high school kids immediately regret. And it turns out that Kenny Hill thinks he made a mistake there too, because he's no longer an Aggie. But as a true freshman, he got on campus and became the backup to someone that we all know and lovingly know as Johnny Football. May he... you know, wherever Johnny is right now, hopefully he's not you know, so drunk and high that he can't function. But Hill was his backup in 2013. He made some cleanup appearances throughout that year, but was largely, you know, just on the bench. In 2014, He won the starting job after Johnny Football went to the NFL, dominated South Carolina in that game that I think everyone will remember. I remember taking a break in a night class that I was in on that evening and checking my phone, and I saw the South Carolina Texas A&M score, and I had to do a double take because I was like, holy crap, this freshman that's starting after Johnny Manziel just lit the world on fire for 2 years, has just thrown for 500 yards and 4 touchdowns, and they're crushing South Carolina right now. Like, wow, this A&M has this new jewel, this new crown, jewel in their crown, and they are just they're going to run away with it with Kenny Hill at the helm. Obviously, that wasn't the case, as he eventually lost the starting job to Kyle Allen midway through that season. You know, he was suspended for a violation of team rules and athletic department policies halfway through that 2014 season. But even before the season started, Melissa, he started to get into some trouble. He was arrested on public intoxication charge in College Station back in March of 2014. So he, you know, it seems like he finally got this opportunity with Johnny Manziel out of the limelight to kind of take over in spring, immediately got a public intoxication, earned his way back in with Sumlin, got the starting job, started off hot, and faded really quickly so that Kyle Allen eventually took over that starting gig. Obviously, you know, Kyle Allen is at Houston now, so neither of these quarterbacks finished their careers at Texas A&M. But it's you've seen really kind of this up and down pattern to Hill's career. But Melissa, my question for you, after kind of looking at his past and seeing where he's come as since he's been at TCU, since he's been a Horned Frog, do you expect more of this kind of up and down, inconsistent kind of behavior, football play, and all of the above, really, from Kenny Hill? Or do you think that he's in a situation now under Gary Patterson with his parents close by, where, you know, now that he's earned this spot, he's going to keep it and he's going to do everything kind of the right way?
Well, you know, I don't want to rile up our friends down in College Station again by, you know, kind of repeating what Doug Meacham said a couple weeks back about some of the, I don't know if culture issues are the thing to say or not, but obviously the discipline at Texas A&M with Johnny Manziel and subsequently Kenny Hill, the expectations off the field were maybe a little bit different than we have seen them to be at TCU. And you know, David Ubbin actually wrote a great story on Sports on Earth earlier this month, and I retweeted it when after the announcement was made, that really talked about how Gary Patterson approached Kenny Hill, the background work that Sonny Cumbie did on him when Kenny left Texas A&M, and just really the homework that they did on this for his off-the-field things before they agreed to allow him to come to TCU, and the meeting that he had to have with Gary Patterson. And one of the things that Patterson talked a lot with Kenny Hill about was Casey Paja. And, you know, we all know Paja's issues, and you know, he ended up, you know, having some drug issues and DUIs and was sent to rehab. And what I loved about what Patterson, the way that he handled Casey and the things that he told Kenny Hill in that interview, according to this article, were, you know, that we're big picture. We're not just looking at what you're going to do for us week to week, and we're not just trying to get you through a football season. And, you know, sure, we can drop you when things get tough off the field, but we're here to help you. Basically said, we're here to help you become a man and to have a future after football too. And I think that the way that they handled him coming in and the work that they did to get him here shows that they've invested in this person, not just this, you know, football robot that can go on the field on Saturdays. And, you know, sure, we all want to believe that about our universities and about our football programs, but I think time and time again, Gary Patterson's kind of proven to be that's what really matters to him at the end of the day. And, of course, winning football games is right up there too. So, you know, Hill's talent is undeniable. You don't go out and do that to South Carolina and follow that up with another pretty impressive performance against Arkansas and, you know, playing so well in his first handful of games and then all of a sudden forget how to play football. I don't think that's the case here unless you're, you know, Joe Spave at Wisconsin. But it looks like if his off-the-field life is together, which by all accounts, I mean, he has been a model citizen off the football field, that his football talent should shine through this year for TCU. He's in the perfect fit. This is a really a lot of veteran leadership in the locker room. You've got guys like Deontay Gray and James McFarland and Tyus Lamina and just some older guys that have kind of been around the block that that have expectations for themselves, for their football team, but also for their football program, and probably aren't going to let anybody get away with some of that stuff. So I think he's in a really good spot. I think if he doesn't succeed, it's because of decisions that he makes, not because of the opportunities that are going to be there for him on the football field. And I expect him to have a really, really good season in what is frankly, you know, probably an easier conference slate than what he would have seen in the SEC.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I like the point that you made about how it's not going to be because of anything on the field. There is, and one of the reasons for that, I think, is because of the amount of talent that surrounds him. Mm-hmm. I saw an interesting conversation on Twitter today. I can't remember who it was from, or I would gladly give those folks a shout out, but it was a conversation about just how loaded the wide receiver and running back positions are and how much pressure that can take off of a new quarterback, especially one in a system that's as wide open as TCU's, because really there's no pressure on Kenny Hill to make these incredible plays that we got used to seeing Boykin make. He just has to get the ball out and get it to where it's supposed to be on time, and then let these talented guys around him, all of these skill positions around him, really kind of take over from there. And, you know, I think that if he does that, then the stats are going to take care of themselves. The wins are going to take care of themselves. And he's going to start to build back at least his football reputation pretty quickly. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we're all, you don't replace a guy like Trayvon Boykin. You don't replace a Josh Doctson, you know, overnight. And we'll always, you know, have those guys kind of at the pinnacle of what TCU offense can be. But there is something to be said about not having a superstar wide receiver like a Josh Doctson that, I'm sure there are times when you're like, well, I got to get it to Josh, or I got to get it to Doc, or, you know, I'm just going to throw it up for this guy because I know he's probably going to make a play. And we saw a lot of those throws from Trayvon Boykin over the last 2 years, but then we saw a lot of those balls being ridiculously caught by Josh Doctson on the other end. So it worked out for TCU. But I think that Hill is in a little bit more of a beneficial spot where there is not one guy that needs to get his 15 touches a game. And there's not one guy that he feels like, man, this guy, you know, I haven't thrown it deep to him. I better just get him his stats. He's got to get his numbers. He's got, you know, he's got someone to impress. I think it's going to be more about, here's my read, here's my second read, here's the guy that's open. I think you'll see with guys like Gray and Slanina and Turpin in the slot, you're going to see a lot of short, quick decision-making throws that are going to be about getting the ball in somebody's hands and allowing them to do what they do well, which is make plays in the open field. So he's going to have every opportunity to succeed in this offense. I think that the biggest concern right now for me is the offensive line, just because we don't know a lot about it. And Patterson, in typical Patterson style, hasn't had a lot of good things to say about them. And I think ultimately that if it was as close as we were led to believe between him and Sawyer, that was a difference maker, is we don't have an offensive line that we've seen perform together as a group. We know Kenny Hill can get outside the pocket and make plays, and Foster Sawyer just isn't quite the athlete that Kenny Hill is. And that's probably the difference maker in deciding your starting quarterback this fall.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a valid point, that the offensive line, especially if it wasn't performing well, could have led to more opportunities for Hill to scramble and move around in the pocket and outside of it and all that stuff. But I do want to point back to Foster's abilities a little bit, and just, you know, he's not a statue back there by any stretch of the imagination. He does have pretty good mobility. So he, you know, I'm obviously, we're both kind of speaking as relative outsiders here, but, you know, I would assume that he would have had plenty of opportunities to show that he does have that mobility as well. But like you said, you know, Hill is a special talent. Hill has that almost elite athleticism. And that definitely would have helped him separate if that was the case with the offensive line. But, you know, I saw something else interesting today is after Hill was announced as the starter, Melissa, and there were these kind of rampant speculations that it's almost assumed that Foster Sawyer is going to transfer now, which I found to be pretty interesting, because if I'm in Foster Sawyer's shoes, I'm not transferring. I'm not transferring this season. Now, 2017, when, you know, Hill, if everything goes well for him, is entrenched as the starter for another year, and then you've got Brennan Wooten with another year under his belt, and you've got Sean Robinson stepping in, then things are starting to get really crowded. But in 2016, I don't think that Foster is going to transfer immediately because he's one injury away from being the starter. I mean, he showed this coaching staff that he has a lot of ability if he really did push Kenny Hill as far and as hard as we think he did. So I'm not on the transfer train quite yet for Foster Sawyer. I'm not buying into that. I didn't know, though, if you had heard anything about that, because I just thought that was really interesting.
Well, you know, I think that, and I've never spoken to Foster personally about this, obviously, and I don't know his family, but I do know some people that know some people. I have a couple friends I went to school with that have some family connections and everything, and from everything I've heard, Foster loves TCU and he loves Fort Worth, and I think if he has any shot of, you know, contributing to this football program, this is his preferred place to be. Now, that being said, he's a kid who was highly recruited out of high school, who had the Alabamas and the big schools on him, you know, to come play quarterback for him. And so I can see a scenario where, you know, after this season, if he doesn't get the opportunities and he wants to pursue a pro career, that, yeah, that might be the best football decision for him. And at that point, I wouldn't begrudge him that, you know, at all. He also might be a great candidate to be a grad transfer somewhere as well, since he's already used up his redshirt year. You know, he might be an immediately eligible guy, you know, either next fall or next December. But I think, like you said, after what the Frogs went through last year on the injury front, it would be silly to assume that you're not going to get a chance to see the field. And one thing that Patterson did bring up this afternoon is he plans to use two quarterbacks. Now, does he mean two quarterbacks against South Dakota? Does he mean two quarterbacks and have a package for Foster? You know, obviously he didn't elaborate on that. But if I'm Foster Sawyer, I'm not trying to leave in the middle of fall camp. I don't think that's the guy that he is anyway. But I think that we need to be preparing for that scenario in the future if he doesn't feel he's going to get the opportunity to have his turn behind center, you know, anytime here before his graduation. And, you know, at that point, I think our best thing is just to wish him well and to hope he gets a chance to have some success somewhere else, because he really does have the talent to contribute. And the Frogs, of course, have some really young studs waiting in the wings as well. And so that may just end up ultimately being the best thing for everybody.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, ultimately, yes. If after this season Hill turns into what we hope he can, you know, and things get a little crowded, I would expect Sawyer to find an opportunity elsewhere at that point. And I'm not saying that I would expect him to stick around even if he had no chance of seeing the field here, because that would be a ridiculous request of him and a ridiculous expectation. I always am bothered by a coach that will say, oh, we plan on using two quarterbacks, because using two quarterbacks never seems to work out. And so I wonder, like you said, is it specific packages for Foster? Is it just against South Dakota State? Because one of the things that I think a two quarterback system does is that it just never allows either quarterback to really get into a rhythm or really get the amount of game reps that they need to feel comfortable running the offense. I think we saw it in 2013 a little bit with Paul Hall and Boykin, especially at the beginning of the year in that LSU game, where we had Boykin come out for a few series and Paul Hall come out for a few series, and we eventually lost that game. And the offense just never seemed to really click for the entirety of that four quarters. And then, they settled it once Paul Hall broke his arm in game number two and Boykin played. And then when Paul Hall came back, you know, he was just kind of the starter at that point. But, you know, I think we saw down at Texas A&M, 2 years ago with Hill and with Kyle Allen, that it doesn't really work. We saw it with Texas A&M again last year that it didn't really work with Murray and with Kyle Allen. Maybe that's an offense thing. Maybe that's a culture thing. We can go on and on. But I don't like the idea of a two-quarterback offense, because if you have two quarterbacks, you know, as the saying goes, if you have two quarterbacks, you have no quarterbacks.
My gut instinct from the beginning of this whole battle was that Kenny Hill would start against South Dakota and Foster Sawyer would, you know, play the second half or start the second half or something like that, and that Patterson wouldn't officially name his starter ahead of the Arkansas game. That obviously isn't the case. I mean, Hill's been given the job, but I think the hope is if you are a top 15 team, even though this is a really good Jackrabbits team, that you can take care of business in the first half and allow Sawyer to get on the field. I think that would be the best case scenario. And again, you know, being able to develop a quality backup behind Hill and have a guy who has some game experience this season would only serve to benefit TCU if, God forbid, we go through anything close to what we went through last year on the injury front. So maybe that's what he's mean. Maybe that's what he's leaning at. I think you're absolutely right. I don't see a scenario where, you know, Hill's going to play a series and Foster's going to come in a series and Hill's going to run three or four series and Foster's going to come back in. I think it may more be situationally, or at least in the early goings of the season, as just kind of a safety net should the worst happen, and he'll be lost for any given period of time to injury.
Yeah, I mean, I get the safety net bit, and I get the cleanup duty bit. I just, you know, situationally even, I'm going to play devil's advocate for you here. I'm going to ask you a question. What situation would there be, or what situation would require Kenny Hill coming out of the game and Foster Sawyer going into the game that's not cleanup duty, and that's not, you know, because of injury? Because, I mean, if you've named Kenny Hill the starter at this point, you're saying that his talent is greater than that of Foster Sawyer. And so I don't see what kind of situation would require Hill to come off the field and Sawyer to go in it if he's not hurt, or if they're not up by, you know, 40.
Two things I can think of, and one of them is completely and totally cheating. But the first one is, we know that Cumbie and Meacham love to play and love to play games and love to run trick plays. And with Hill's athletic ability and Sawyer's ability to move around a little bit more than I gave him credit for earlier, like you said, I could definitely see both quarterbacks being on the field at the same time. I could see Hill split out. You could do some reverses, double passes. You know, we've seen the Frogs use that double pass more in the last 2 years, and I think I saw him use in the last 15. So putting a guy like Hill as a component in that could really, really ruin some defenses. But that is totally so. The other one I could see too, and again, this is kind of, I don't know that this is going to be a regular occurrence, but, you know, in a late quarter situation or a late half situation, you know, if you've got a long field in front of you, I don't think there's anybody that questions that the Foster Sawyer has the better arm, you know, the better deep ball throwing ability of the two guys. And so it could be one of those scenarios, you know, you come on, you got a minute and a half and you're on the 23-yard line and you're trying to go down and score at the end of the first half. Maybe that's where he gets a package or he gets a series and he's allowed to kind of come in and run the offense to move him down the field in a short period of time. Of course, with the TCU offense that we now know and love, a minute and a half might as well be an eternity when it comes to scoring.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you could probably score two or three times in a minute and a half
easily. I don't even think I could get down the field in a minute and a half, but, you know, TCU offense could score three times. It's fine.
You know, that might have to be the next Frogs of War, like Periscope podcast, is us timing in the 100-yard dash or something like that.
Gosh, that would be amazing. I'd pay money
Frogs
to see that.
Frogs of War staffer could run the 100-yard dash the fastest, or the 40-yard dash.
You know, Mason is probably the youngest, right? So I'd have to put my money on him just based on youth. I don't know. Scotty might just have a little bit in him we just don't know about.
I was about to say, I think Scott would take it. I don't want to underestimate Marshall, because I think that with a guy like him, he's kind of that slot receiver build. He's got to have some quickness.
Yeah, but I feel like we can stride out on Marshall, though. Like, I feel pretty confident. He's going to beat me, but I'm going to stride out on him. I don't know. This needs to happen. I think we just found our first tailgate game for Saturday.
Yeah, we're going to have to figure this out and set it all up. Oh, man. Well, you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the South Dakota State game that a top 15 team should take care of business to where the second string can come in and really kind of get some extended playing time in the second half of the game. You mentioned that, I'm sure, because you know that TCU is, in fact, a top 15 team. According to the latest AP Top 25 poll, they're number 13. They're wedged right between number 12, Michigan State, and number 14, Washington. Melissa, have you had a chance to look at this AP poll? I know it came out quite a few days ago now.
Yeah, I have had a chance to look it over a little bit.
So, you know, you've got the usual suspects in the top 7-8, really. You've got Alabama, Clemson, Oklahoma, Florida State, LSU, Ohio State, Michigan, Stanford. And then things get a little strange to me. You get Tennessee at number 9, Notre Dame at 10, Ole Miss at 11, Michigan State at 12, that's fine, TCU at 13, Washington at 14, and then you have other teams in the top top 25, like Louisville at 19, USC at 20, you've got Florida at 25, and you've got other teams like Miami lingering right outside the top 25, Texas A&M lingering right outside the top 25. We see this every year, don't we, that certain conferences kind of get the boost based on these preseason polls. But Melissa, how are you feeling about TCU's 13 ranking, and how do you feel about some of these other teams that made their way into the top 25?
Well, I'm assuming by conferences that get a boost, you're talking about Houston being 15th because of their status in the American Conference. That's what you're going for there, right? Yeah. Okay. I still believe that the best scenario going forward with the playoffs remaining at the same structure that it is would be to not release the polls until the first week of October. This is the biggest waste of time. You're given some teams ridiculous mountains to climb before they even step foot on the field. You're giving other teams the benefit of the doubt that they don't deserve. By putting LSU 5, if they go 1-3 in their first four SEC games, they're still going to be a top 20 team. It's just the most asinine exercise and ridiculousness. But you know what? It's a lot of clicks and it's a lot of money, and fans absolutely love to argue over what they deserve when they haven't seen their team step foot on the field yet. So good for them. TCU is in a good spot. All that being said, it's pointless and ridiculous, but hey, I like where we're ranked. That works out well for us. I wouldn't want to be a top 10 team. I would be perfectly fine hanging around number 18 or so to begin. But I think with when you consider that you are replacing, the most talented quarterback we've seen come through, arguably the inarguably most talented receiver we've seen come through, a pretty good offensive line, pretty good running back, and a couple members of the defense all graduate, that, having TCU hover right around the middle of the pack is probably a fair spot for them. I think they'll finish higher than that, but that's because, I'm a purple tinted glasses wearer, but I'm okay with that. I think, OU absolutely deserves to be in that number three spot to begin the season. Oklahoma State being ranked and Baylor being ranked near the bottom of the top 25 makes a lot of sense to me as well. So I think the Big 12 is actually pretty fairly done. That being said, I don't know that I've seen a competent LSU quarterback in a decade or more. And while their defense has been really, really good, and they have one of the scariest players in all of college football lining up behind said unknown quarterback, that's just number five to start the season. It's just kind of ridiculous in my opinion. Tennessee, a ton of talent, have yet to prove they can win, put together a string of meaningful games. So you want to start them at number 10 based on a couple nice performances and losses last year. Good for you. Notre Dame just lost a couple really key pieces and had the indefinite suspension of a couple more. So I think they're deserving of that top 10 ranking, but holding on to it's going to be pretty tough. And Washington, they've signed some great defensive players. I know their quarterback, sophomore Jake Browning. He's from my hometown, my neck of the woods. This kid, I've followed his high school career. He's totally talented. I don't think he's ready to help Washington take that next big step. And I just think that the Pac-12 is so top heavy this year that I can't see them overcoming Stanford or UCLA if Rosen is as good as advertised, which I expect him to be. I think Washington's going to be another one of those teams that starts ranked and ends up on the wrong end of the top 25 by the end of the season. SC is an interesting one to me. That may be one of the more interesting ones in the poll. They've got the talent, but they've got some unknowns at quarterback. They've got a great wide receiver in Juju Smith and some really nice pieces on defense. But I don't know that they're quite ready to turn the corner. I think we'll see them stay in the rankings, but probably still in that 20 to 25 range by the time all is said and done.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything that you just said. I know that, being from California, you've had a lot more opportunity to watch some of these Pac-12 teams growing up, at least, than I did. And I'm assuming that you keep up with them a little bit more frequently than I do. You named players that I've never heard of before, so that's going to tip me off on that. But, USC did just take TCU 2017 commit James Lynch away from the Horned Frogs. So they did win that battle, but
team
get them on the real
out
schedule. Oh, come on. We're not going to start that tonight. We're not. We don't have the time. I don't have the energy to argue you down from this ridiculous stance that you're holding. There is no way. This is all I'm going to say about it. There is no way on this planet that anyone in their right mind should think that In-N-Out is better than Whataburger. There's just no way. No way that those people should exist.
You know
but
what?
Yeah,
I'm gonna let you hang out in your deluded world there's no way an In-N-Out burger isn't better than a Whataburger burger. But
first of all, it is. Second of all, you have so many more options at Whataburger, so you can even go beyond the burger itself to all of the phenomenal other options. And I'm not just talking other sandwich and burger options. I'm talking breakfast options. I'm talking dessert options. You have options at Whataburger, all of which are top quality for fast food, all of which are superior to their alternatives at In-N-Out Burger. So,
this there's going to be a special podcast. It's going to be like an after-school special podcast just on In-N-Out versus Whataburger. We'll have the final reckoning one of these days. When it sounds like an off-season topic, though, I would think.
Most definitely. And we are undoubtedly too close to the regular season to really get into in-depth into that right now. Also, there might be some screaming and cursing and yelling, and we're trying to keep this PG for all of the children that are listening at 9 p.m. at night Central Time. So, you know, there's that. But, you know, I think one thing, Melissa, that comes kind of with TCU's number 13 ranking, and will definitely start to crop up more because of Kenny Hill being named the starting quarterback, is something that I've seen recently in the media with folks writing a lot of articles about TCU, is there's kind of this weird weird kind of position that TCU finds itself in where they're clearly one of the front runners in the Big 12, a very top-heavy Big 12 this year, where many people have them finishing in the top two, top three in the conference in their preseason polls and rankings and all this kind of stuff. But at the same time, there seems to be this kind of movement where folks, and I think Kirk Herbstreit kind of can be the face of this movement now based on some tweets he had yesterday or the day before, but there's this kind of movement where TCU is now kind of this trendy sleeper pick to win the Big 12 and to make it into the Final Four, into the playoffs. So, you know, I find it very interesting that TCU is in this position of being on one hand, this favorite and this powerhouse that is expected to reload and not take time to rebuild. But on the other hand, this team that can really creep up and surprise you in some ways. What do you think about that? Like that, I feel like that's a really interesting position for a school to be in.
Well, absolutely. The respect that TCU and Gary Patterson have earned on a national stage to be among the "we don't rebuild, we reload" programs in the country. I think that that's evidence of that being a true thing at this point. I also think part of that is, you know, part of the three things in life you can count on: death, taxes, and a highly rated Oklahoma team crapping the bed at some point in the season. So I think that just there's such a history of that, that there's a lot of people that are just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop for the Sooners, despite the fact that they really most likely are the best bet to win the Big 12 conference. And I think it's just one of those things where there's still so many unknowns. Texas, by all accounts, should be better and should be successful and has put together enough strong recruiting classes to where you believe they could be better. But at the same time, until they have an established quarterback, it's really hard to say they're going to be returned to the power seat in the Big 12 conference. And with all the question marks surrounding Baylor, obviously, if we just stick even just to on the field, those are some questions. Oklahoma State just hasn't been quite ready to take that leap in the last couple of years. And while Texas Tech may have a guy who ends up being the best player in the country by the end of the season and Patrick Mahomes, until they show they can make a stop on the football field defensively, it's really hard to put a whole lot of stock into them as an actual, you know, championship type contender, though I think they will be right there at the end of the season. So, you know, for TCU, who has fought to get a seat at the table for the last decade and a half, to be a team now that has a placard at the table annually is such a dramatic turnaround from the school I attended way back when to what we see today. It really is not only an unusual, but kind of a shocking change of direction and change of mentality for the Horned Frogs and for the program that Gary Patterson has built. So I think it's the right spot for us to be until we see some of these guys actually perform on the field. We don't know that they're as good as we think they should be. But at the same time, to underestimate a Gary Patterson team, especially one that looks to have that type of defense that he thrives on, would be a mistake, not only locally, but nationally as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. There's just a really interesting kind of tight wire that TCU is walking. And I hope that they lean into this role of kind of sleeper and underdog more so than this idea of favorite, because like you mentioned, it does favor Gary Patterson's mentality and kind of coaching style. And I just think it fits TCU so much better than this label of front runner. Did you see the Blue Blood rankings that came out today on ESPN?
I did miss those, actually.
Where some guys ranked programs in order of their importance to college football. And I think TCU came in, what, number 31 on that list? Something like that, somewhere.
I had missed that, yeah, but
I think they came in around 30, 31 on that list, which I can't remember, you know, who the top 25 were or anything like that, but I think that's pretty good. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that that's pretty good for a team that's only been in a power conference for four seasons and has already done so much. So I think there's definitely just there are a lot of really interesting, I think, storylines going in to this season because there are so many different ways TCU can continue to build its reputation.
Well, if you are at all worried about TCU players or coaches buying into the hype and not playing with that typical Gary Patterson chip on his shoulder, I'm not sure if you saw his response to Kirk Herbstreit picking TCU for the playoffs. But when asked what he thought about that, I think Carlos Mendez asked him, he said he hasn't seen him practice yet. So all that to say that while it's nice to get that national love, Patterson is doing his job to make sure that his kids don't quite buy into the hype just yet. And that's, I think, where we want them to be.
If Gary Patterson ever had his own sitcom, it would 100% be called That's So Gary. Because I hear quotes like that, I'm just like, that is so Gary Patterson. It's just his mentality is that this team is not good enough. This team is not fast enough. This team is not strong enough yet, but I'm going to get them there. And so it's just, oh man, I love hearing him say stuff like that because you know that he's fired up about it. His kids are going to get fired up about it and they're going to come out and try to prove everyone else wrong. Man.
10 out of 10. I would watch that sitcom, by the way. 10 out of 10.
Every episode. I wouldn't have to DVR it because I would just watch it live every single time. I would make time for it. Like, absolutely.
And thank you for bringing up, I'm glad that we got to Whataburger and In-N-Out because I just have to say, as we're recording this, I'm getting bombarded with texts and tweets from people telling me how stupid I am. So,
good. You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks for that.
You are on the losing team, and now you know it. So, that's good.
Good.
So, we are going to go to the phones, everybody. I've tweeted out the phone number if you missed it on the Frogs of War Twitter account. But if you did miss it, it is 657-383-1319. 657-383-1319 here on the Frogs of War Live podcast with Jamie and Melissa. We're going to go to our first caller. He's been on hold for quite a while now, and I think I know who he is. Hello. Scott?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Good afternoon. Good evening, everyone. This is good. This is Scott reporting from Arlington at the formerly known Globe Life Park in Arlington, originally Ballpark in Arlington, now Globe Life Park.
Can I just make a timeout here for some important non-TCU news?
Yeah.
We are one snap into game three of the Dallas Cowboys preseason, and Tony Romo is on the ground clutching his shoulder.
Are you kidding me?
You're kidding.
Are you kidding me?
Go Cowboys.
Oh, hang on. I gotta go Dak Prescott. I got to go pick up Dak Prescott.
Wow.
Are you kidding me or are you serious right now?
Nope, that is 100% a serious thing. So those of you, shout out to those of you watching the Dallas Cowboys preseason game in the background. It was a good run.
Sweet baby.
But Scott, you're having a much better time. Last I saw, the Rangers were up 8-0, so not a bad night at the ballpark.
Yeah, I'm having a great time. Most definitely. I'm here with a group of Cleveland friends, so they are all reveling in you know, what we have here as a unfolded tonight, which is a 8-0 game. Oh, Beltre has lifted it to right field. Oh, at the warning track.
Oh, warning track.
Yeah, just like Whataburger, just short of the quality there.
Bless you, Scotty.
Oh, Scotty.
So Scott, you know, not to get too deep into Team Whataburger, Team In-N-Out, but I'm not sure if you heard Jamie and I's other discussion, 100-yard dash, Frogs of War bloggers. Who's your favorite to be the fastest Frogs of War blogger?
I'm going to go with Mason because he's got the young, fresh legs.
Yeah.
He's a guy that, you know, that may not be a starter, but he's going to come in there, you know, second quarter and really burn some guys, you know?
I like it. Yeah, I was Team Mason as well. Jamie threw in for Marshall out of the slot. You know, he's got those quicks. So I kind of buy into that as well. But yeah, I think overall we'd be a very, very slow and probably not highly talented group. So I'm glad there won't be us stepping foot on the field here in about 9 days.
Yeah, most definitely. I would never even come close to sniffing the Olympic team because I am very slow. So anyone that would pick me in any sort of sprint would pretty much be up for a loss there.
That's good. So what do you think of the announcement that Kenny Hill is TCU starter? To very few surprise, but still to know officially, how does that kind of make you feel?
Honestly, I'm feeling pretty good about it. You know, I was thinking about it earlier today before the announcement officially came down. And, it's clear everybody knew kind of what was going to happen. I feel for Foster Sawyer. I really wish, the hometown kid with obviously talent coming out of high school, was going to do well and sort of be the more or less the pocket passer in an air raid system that was going to succeed. That may be the case down the road. But, at this point, I'm feeling pretty good about Kenny Hill being the quarterback and leading this offense to what kind of everybody feels like it should be and it can be moving forward. I think that obviously, he may not be a Trevon Boykin. It's kind of hard to come by, but with Cumby kind of leading the charge and as far as the quarterbacks go, I really think that, with the maturity that he seems to have been showing thus far, I think he can really take it to kind of the next level. I think at this point, the biggest question mark on offense, at least, is probably the offensive line. But even then, we have so much depth from, so many guys getting injured last year and the line shuffling around. And I don't even know how many starts we have on offensive line, but it's got to be, at least a couple for most of the guys on there. So overall, feeling pretty good about it. I don't see much drop-off, to be perfectly honest, from Devon Boykin down to Kenny Hill.
Well, I do want to. I think that's really great insight, Scott. I do want to say for all of you folks who are not freaking out about the Dallas Cowboys, Romo did walk off the field. He did walk off the field, but not all hope is lost. Okay, not all hope is lost. But we do have another caller on the line, Melissa. This is a guy who really had a lot of questions for us last week, but couldn't get on because we never ended up taking calls. So we're going to let him on the line first. His name is Kyle. You might know him. All right, Scotty, I'm going to mute you because you're getting kind of loud.
Go for it.
But this is a guy that you might know as YellMK if you follow him on Twitter. You're a smart person. If you don't, you need to go follow him right now. But we're going to get to him. Kyle, how are you, buddy?
Yes, I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Welcome to the
Frog Live
podcast, man.
I appreciate y'all taking the call.
Absolutely.
I felt pretty threatened that if we didn't, that you were going to give us hell about it. So partially we wanted to, partially I feared for my life. So
yeah,
I may have muted you on Twitter for 24 hours. So just saying.
I didn't post any Olympic gifts. Come on.
I just want to speak for just 1 second on behalf of all Frogs War followers. How much I appreciate y'all pumping articles out, the news in the summer, the dead of summer. I know you get paid handsomely for it, it really has enhanced my experience as a fan, as an alum. I'm a proud class of 2005 alum, so just want to thank you guys for all the work you do.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Kyle.
Yeah. So I did have a lot of questions, but I thought we could answer them in a quick format. So work with me here, all right? So just answer the question, what happens first? All right, so you can discuss your reasoning if you want or you don't have to. It's your party. All right, so Jamie Dixon leads TCU basketball to win an NCAA tournament game, or Reagan Peabody takes TCU women's basketball to the Sweet 16. What happens first?
Ooh, Melissa, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'm going to say right now it's Reagan Peabody's show. I think that Jamie Dixon is going to get there, but I think Peabody's got the talent to get TCU to the Sweet 16 this season. I also think women's basketball is just a lot more top heavy than it is heavy all around. And for Dixon, while I love what he's done since he stepped foot on campus, obviously, he's probably 2 to 3 years away from getting the Frogs over the hump at the Big 12 and to the promised land. I think they're possibly an NIT team this year. I think they're a bubble team in the NCAA a year after that. But they're still going to be really, really young. While I think Pebley has hit her stride and is about to experience kind of the prime of TCU women's basketball. And I think she's got a legit shot to take her team to the Sweet 16 this spring.
Jeez. I feel like that's a really good argument, Melissa. The one thing that kind of hangs me up is that even in men's basketball, even though it is deeper at the collegiate level than women's basketball, like you mentioned, it really only takes one or two elite players to turn a program around. And we're starting to see some of those players commit to TCU. Some of those kids are already on campus. You've got Jalen Fisher. You've got Alex Robinson, the kid who transferred from Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. Hey, there's a trend. And so you've got these kids that are coming on campus. TCU only lost one senior off of last year's team. And yeah, it was not a great team. It was kind of the final death knell of Trent Johnson's career at TCU. But there is undoubtedly some talent on that squad. And so I think I agree with you. I think they're a bubble NIT team this year, or solidly in the NIT mix. I think that next year, if these young kids can come in and play well, and really, really buy into what Jamie Dixon is trying to get them to do, which it seems like they're already buying into if they're committing to a school like TCU, to a program like TCU, that there is serious potential to get to the tournament a lot quicker than folks think. Because if you think about how deep the Big 12 is and how much benefit of the doubt Big 12 teams get versus other teams and other conferences, it's almost kind of like the SEC effect in football, where I think we had, what, seven teams from the Big 12 make the tournament last year. Tech in the seventh place in the conference made the tournament, and they were still a nine seed.
Yeah.
So if you're talking about that as the threshold for being a bubble team to the tournament, and you're top or bottom quarter of the conference, bottom third of the conference, I think there's a lot of potential to get to the tournament next year and possibly win a game. I do like what you said, though, about Reagan Peebly, because she is a phenomenal coach and she's got those girls playing at such a high level. So I am going to agree with you in the end, but I think that we can raise the expectations for Jamie Dixon a lot, because he's already kind of proving that he's a miracle worker just in recruiting. And so once these guys get on the court for TCU, you know, I think all bets are really off.
Great question, though. Great question.
Phenomenal.
Wow, that was entirely comprehensive. Thank you. All right. What happens first? Jim Schlossnagel wins the national championship, or Gary Patterson leads the football team to the playoffs?
Oh, man. All right, Jamie, you get to go first on this one.
Okay, dang it. Okay, so both of those things could, theoretically happen this season, like, quote, this season for both of those programs. So, if Patterson does that this year, I guess he wins, even though Schloss will not have had another opportunity since this past season to do it. I don't know that TCU football, gosh, I don't want to say this out loud. I don't want to be that guy. I'm going to go with Jim Schlossnagel in a national championship. That's just because I think that this TCU squad is so close. I mean, they've been knocking at the door of a final pairing in the College World Series for three straight years now. And they've still got incredible talent. They've still got incredible depth at the pitching rotation because of some of those guys that came back. And I think that those guys are really going to be out for blood next year. With the current state of the Big 12, like you said, Melissa, a while ago, that there are some question marks in the Big 12 as far as quality of teams go. But I look at Oklahoma and I see a team that just seems bound and determined to get back because of what happened last year at Clemson. And I always will fear that even if TCU is the team that wins the Big 12, that there's going to be some kind of way that the committee keeps TCU out. It's just something in the pit of my stomach tells me that they're going to do everything in their power to keep TCU out of the playoffs. I know that that's a totally biased and irrational line of thinking, but for me, that's just the way I think. So I'm going to take Schlossnagel and I'm going to take baseball. And you can write it down, they're winning the national championship next year.
I have to agree with you on this one, too. I think the TCU baseball team is so deep and so talented. And in baseball, more than anything, that doesn't necessarily always matter. Coastal Carolina was a really great team, but they didn't have, probably near the big name talent that anybody else in Omaha did this last summer. And they got hot at the right time. They played like a team and, they galvanized right when they needed to and won the whole dang thing. And you know, as crushing as that was as a TCU fan, it was a lot of fun for them and their fans and nationally as well. And so baseball is so much about getting hot at the right time. That being said, man, this TCU team they're special. They have something extra. You know, they play for so much more than just the game of baseball and just each other. And so I think that this is the year they win it all. And you know, I don't know if it's just because we've been around for some of the lean years, Jamie, and some of those small conference years or what, but it does always seem like TCU will get right to that precipice, but getting over the mountaintop has been really, really hard for Gary Patterson and the Horned Frogs. And going undefeated in a conference when you play everybody, it's just a really tough thing to do. And I'm with you. I think TCU is going to either have to lose a game at the right time or is going to have to run the table to get in. And that's just going to be a tough thing to do this year, especially when you have a really, really good top to bottom Pac-12, two really excellent teams in the ACC and Clemson and Florida State. The SEC, which is always going to get a team in the playoffs, even if their best squad is six, they'll find a way to justify it. And the Big Ten with Ohio State, Michigan, and Michigan State, as well as Iowa, all looking like contenders again. So I'd all in on TCU baseball in 2017. Let's win the whole darn thing. And I hope that TCU football can follow a year later with their own playoff berth.
Great.
All right.
Excellent. All right, Kyle, so hit us again.
Okay. So for the sake of the fall, I hope you guys are both wrong, but I do appreciate the answers. last one, and then I'll let you guys get to some other calls. So what happens first? TCU lands its first five-star recruit in football, or Art Briles gets another head coaching job in college?
I'm sorry, that might be the question of the day.
Will you repeat that, please?
You want me to repeat it?
Yeah.
Please do.
Okay. So TCU football lands its first five-star recruit, or Art Briles gets another head coaching job in college.
Head coaching job or coaching job?
Head coaching job.
Okay, I got this one. This is easy. This is far and away. TCU is signing their first five-star recruit in February. Mark it down. Put it in Sharpie. It's happening. Guarantee it. You have it on my word right now. It is happening this February. Art Briles is going to be the offensive coordinator somewhere in the fall. It's looking very, very disgustingly like it's going to be Auburn. I think he joins that staff. I think it's a couple with Jared Stidham going with him. I think it's a couple years before he is a head coach. But because it's college football and because at the end of the day, as much as we wish it wasn't, it's all about the money. He will work again. I just think it's going to be a while before a program decides it's worth diving in and getting your hands dirty by hiring him as your lead dog.
Yeah, Melissa, I agree with you. It hurts my heart that Art Briles is going to coach again at the collegiate level. I mean, it's like you said, it's going to happen. It's going to be a terrible statement to all of the girls on campus at whatever school he ends up at that he would be brought in to be responsible for growing up some young men. But yes, I agree. I also do think TCU is going to sign a five-star recruit rather quickly. I'm going to put a name to that. I have no inside information. I would like to start by saying that. I have no inside information on this, but I'm feeling really, really good about a kid who was formerly, I believe, committed to Baylor and has decommitted a while ago and is now on the block. He is a five-star kid. His name is Baron Browning. I have no facts to back this up, everybody. No facts, but I'm just feeling good about it. I think that will be Baron Browning will be the five-star recruit that TCU gets this year, and so TCU gets a five-star recruit before Art Briles is the head coach again.
Agreed.
That was awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for calling.
That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. I'll see y'all on the third.
Yeah, let's go. Go Frogs.
Team Whataburger is out.
Oh, killing me. Well, Jamie, I don't know if you saw, but the before we take another call here, the week one depth chart is out, and there is at least one very interesting note on this when it comes to special teams. The place kicker for week one will be either Brandon Hatfield or Ryan Grass, with no Jonathan Song to be seen.
Yeah, kicker is really kind of a position that makes you freak out if you're a TCU fan right now. Just God hope that, you know, we just won't be in a situation where we need like a 47-yard kick to win the game or to tie a game or, you know, with the season on the line.
Yeah, hopefully Song is not out for very long, but it seems that toe injury that he suffered a couple weeks back is going to keep him from starting the first game. Just for those of you who aren't aware, Brandon Hatfield is a 6'3" junior. He's out of California. He went to Ontario Christian School. He did not see any game action last season, but was an All-CIF player in high school. So clearly has some experience kicking in big games. Two field goals of over 50 yards in high school, broke several high school records. So he's got some skins under his belt here, but nothing at the collegiate level. So again, it'll be his show. Ryan Braff, I'll just give you guys a quick little information on him as well. Those of you that aren't familiar, he is a redshirt freshman, also a California kid, 6 foot out of Colver Military Academy, redshirted this past year. So also does not have any in-game kicking experience at the collegiate level, but was a top 30 kicker in the country and top 50 punter nationally and a four-star recruit in the kicking academy circuit. So looks like those two guys will be the ones getting the opportunities. Again, you know, you hope in that first game, and I'm not trying to disrespect South Dakota State at all. Please don't think that. But against a lower tier school, you hope that you don't come in a situation where you need a game-winning kick, but you also hope that they get an opportunity to get a couple under their belt before we face off against Arkansas, where I'm sure that points will be at a premium with those two teams.
Yeah. They're both walk-ons. That's the only thing that bothers me is that both of these kickers that are backing up Song are walk-ons. And so get well soon, Jonathan. Get well soon. So we've got another caller. Kyle, we're going to let you go. Thank you for all of your phenomenal questions. We'll be sure to get you back on the line for some quick hits again next time. But we've got another guy who's ready with a few questions of his own. His name is Will. And Will, hello. You are now on with Jamie and Melissa on the Frogs of War Live podcast.
Well, thank you, guys. First question is, who – I know who you think is going to join the Big 12, but in a dream world, who would you prefer to be the best fit to join the Big 12?
That's a good question. Are you saying just two teams if they expand to 12 or four teams if they expand to 14?
Well, I think just two, since it's named the Big 12, I think there should be 12 teams there.
I think that's a valid argument. I definitely do.
When has logic ever applied to the Big 12? Come on, Will.
This is also a fair point. This is a good point, counterpoint that we have going on. Will, I think, Melissa, we touched on this a little bit in our first live podcast. Will, I think that Cincinnati, in my eyes, is pretty much the clear number one at this point. They're a geographic fit. They're a television market fit. Their football tradition is decent enough to where they're a good football fit. Their basketball program, I think, will fit in very well in the Big 12. They have a large alumni base, and they also open up a new kind of recruiting space geographically that the Big 12 hasn't really been able to tap into in that kind of Rust Belt area, especially in Ohio, where the Buckeyes and other Big Ten schools have tended to dominate. So I think Cincinnati is a really clear number one. Once you get past Cincinnati, there are probably two or three schools that have a really legitimate argument. The first one is BYU. They have a good football tradition. They're a phenomenal academic school. Geographically, they're not exactly a good fit, but it's not a deal breaker. They have a massive alumni base. They already have an established tier three television network in BYU TV. I feel like they already have kind of the structures in place to be a part of a Power Five conference. That being said, all of the LGBTQ arguments that have come out against them in the recent weeks, I do think need to be listened to at the very least. I don't know how that affects the Big 12's line of thinking. I don't know how that affects Big 12 presidents or the board of regents or whoever it is that's, ultimately going to make this decision on who to expand to. I don't know how that affects their decision or the call that they make. But I do think it is something that will be a topic of conversation. And so, you know, I think, but I do think BYU has a good resume for getting into the Big 12. Beyond them, Houston, I know that it would be hard to envision another Texas school getting into the Big 12. It would be the fifth school, and that that would be, I think, hard for recruiting. But it would also help the Big 12 kind of regain the Houston market that they I think largely lost when Texas A&M went to the SEC. Texas A&M also opened up recruiting in Houston to the SEC a lot more. So that would kind of help TCU or help the Big 12 fight back against some of that mess that Texas A&M created when they left the conference. Frankly, though, I don't know that Houston has the academic pedigree, the facilities pedigree, or frankly, the athletic pedigree. They had a great football season last year. They had a good football season 3 or 4 years ago. But beyond that, the record books are pretty thin at the University of Houston, especially if you go back 15 years or so. So I just don't know that they stack up, especially when you're comparing them to Cincinnati or BYU. And then the final team that I would throw into this kind of tier two underneath Cincinnati would be UConn. You talk about them academically, they're phenomenal. Facilities-wise, they're pretty good. Their football team isn't great, but their basketball team is one of the best in the country from just a pedigree standpoint, and that's definitely going to help what is a phenomenal basketball conference in the Big 12. Geographically, they are also capable of partnering with Virginia, West Virginia, kind of starting to create a little pocket of schools on the other side of the Mississippi River, with Cincinnati and West Virginia and UConn all over there. So those would be the four that I would consider for those two spots. You know, I think all of the other schools that have been listed, I know Melissa's probably going to talk about East Carolina here in a second. But I, you know, I don't think that ECU, Memphis, or any of the Florida directional schools or Tulane really have enough to make a legitimate argument. Same goes for Colorado State and New Mexico and Boise State and San Diego State and all of the, 20 schools that have bid now. I think it's really down to those four.
I think you made really great points. You know, UConn, it makes so much sense. It's so little sense all at the same time to me that it's hard for me to wrap my head around it. I hadn't even, until you were just talking now, thought about UConn women's basketball and what that would do to basketball in the Big 12. I mean, there would be some excitement, I think, around the women's basketball program at TCU that we just haven't seen in forever, because you bring UConn to your home floor once a year. You're guaranteed to get a little bit more national attention. I am a big fan of ECU as a Big 12 team. I know I am the one person that is pushing for them, but I think if you add Cincinnati, which to me is the automatic, if we're going to expand, they better be a part of the conversation. And ECU, you've now built kind of a stable and almost as logical as it can be geographic footprint for the conference. I think that football program has been on the cusp of being good. They aren't quite what TCU was leading up into their Big 12 invite, but they're not really as far off as people say. They've had some really ugly looking seasons. They've had some bad records, but they've been able to recruit at a fairly high level for a mid-major. They're in a nice talent area, and I don't see any reason why they couldn't become, you know, not necessarily the premier football program, but at the same time, is there any reason they couldn't be a more solid, stable program in the state of North Carolina than Duke, UNC, or Wake Forest, or NC State? I think that the opportunity is there for them to do so. So Memphis, I give them a little bit more credence than Jamie does, probably, only because I think that at the end of the day, if we look at this, it's going to be about money first, football second, money third, football fourth, and everything else, you know, start kind of at fifth and below, and the money is there for Memphis. It's a city that's hungry, I think, for big time football, and I do believe if they had the backing of a major conference behind them, could get competitive, not be, you know, to the level of an annual contender, but could easily kind of grow to be in the K-State, you know, even, you know, pre-Briles kind of, or early Briles Baylor level too, within a couple of years. And you know, I think we need to bring teams that are going to increase the overall respect of the Big 12, but at the same time, you know, look at what else the schools have to offer. And I think Memphis has a lot more to offer than just, you know, what they're doing on the field football-wise. of course, I'll be interested to see what they look like without Paxton Lynch and Justin Fuente as well.
Yeah, see, Melissa, that's the one thing about Memphis that really kind of gets to me. If Fuente had re-upped at Memphis and stuck around for another few years and really worked to build on what he had started, then, yeah, I think Memphis would be a lot more appealing. Yeah, they've got huge money but with FedEx supporting them left and right. But, you know, I just think their resume is too thin.
Yeah, and you're not wrong there. And I think Houston will be an interesting scenario, too. If they don't get the invite this year and that process lags on, is Tom Herman going to stick around, or is he going to jump ship to Baylor, Texas, Texas A&M, or any other of a handful of major conference jobs that will certainly be offered to him in the offseason?
Well, I don't want to see Tom Herman's career die at Texas A&M, but at the same time, I do want to see Tom Herman's career die at Texas A&M. Yeah, because, I mean, if Baylor and Texas are his other two options, I definitely don't want him going there.
I don't want him in our conference. He is legit. He's as real as it gets. He's going to be successful wherever he goes next.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Will, you got anything else for us?
Yeah, sure. What would it take for you all to stop having the SMU annual game?
That's a good question.
They were not good last year.
No, they were not. And, you know, Will, they always kind of – we're their Super Bowl, right? So they always rise up and give us more of a challenge than they should. You know, that second half last year was way more harrowing than it should have been. You know, I think what it would take to get SMU off the schedule for me is the assurance that they would be replaced by a better team. Because it would be too easy, I think, with the future schedule, non-conference schedule that we have going on with good teams like Arkansas and Ohio State, and you've got, I think, Cal in the mix, and you've got Washington in the mix, right? And you've got a bunch of these other schools, Power 5 schools already on the schedule for future seasons. It would be really easy to dump SMU and then snatch up another FCS team or another League of 5 team. And call it a day. But I think if you're dropping SMU from the schedule, and you're dropping them not because they're a rivalry gone south, but because they're really just not a quality opponent anymore, then you have to drop them and add someone better. So I would only like to see SMU off the schedule if they were going to be replaced with a Power 5 team.
I actually think that we're not too far from SMU not being a laughingstock anymore. I think they scare me a little bit this year, because this is always about the type of team TCU has and about the type of team SMU has, where things get a little bit hairy and they kind of did that to us last year, but I still never really doubted that the Frogs were going to pull it out. This is a game that scares me just a little bit, not enough to think we're going to lose, but where I'll be in Dallas kind of biting my fingernails a little bit leading up to game time. I think Chad Morris is a heck of a football coach. I think he's been recruited impressively well and recruited strictly from Texas, which has made him a ton of fans among the high school coaching ranks. And you know, the thing about high school football in Texas, those coaches carry a lot of power and do a lot of the decision making with the parents and their players too. And so I think the Ponies will be able to compete in the American Conference, not with Houston necessarily, but I don't think it's that long before they're bowl eligible. So for me, I would much rather see TCU drop scheduling FCS schools, although I know that that really is important for their budgets and they need those paydays. But I would much rather not play an FCS opponent, keep SMU on the schedule, continue with our playing a Power 5 opponent every year, and then add another Group of 5 school along the lines of a Memphis or an ECU or somebody, Colorado State, somebody kind of interesting, but that isn't quite up to that level. I want a good preseason. I want a challenging preseason, but I also want a preseason that I feel confident we can get out of 2-1 or 3-0 each and every year. And I think letting the SMU rivalry die, while it makes a lot of sense on the field, would be a little bit unfortunate for both schools when it came down to it.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right.
All right, that was Will, everybody. Give Will a round of applause. He did really well. Next, we have a good friend of mine and Melissa's, I think, or at least internet friends, because he also writes for the website, frogsofwar.com. I think you all have heard of it. His name is Mason, and he now joins us on the phone. Mason, how are you, dude? How are you doing, buddy?
I am fantastic. How are you guys?
Mason,
we're doing well.
Our fastest Frogs of War blogger, according to an absolutely no proof poll.
We think. Oh. Mason, were you listening earlier when Melissa and I had this conversation? We don't know, but we need to find out who the fastest runner is on the Frogs of War staff. And we think that in the clubhouse, Vegas would have you as the leader.
I run a 4:40, but before my injury, that was for my injury, but now I don't know. I think Marshall's a sleeper pick, honestly. Travis, too. I feel like Travis has longer strides than I do.
Travis is still in the honeymoon phase of marriage. Like, he's getting cooked for. I guarantee you he's not in sprint shape right now. Sorry, Travis. Love you, buddy. But I don't see you beating the pack here.
Yeah, I bumped into too many tailgates last year to even have him in the top three. So.
Yeah, I hadn't even considered him. Sorry, Travis.
That's fair. I don't know.
He's getting roasted. I know he's listening too, so he's not happy right now.
I mean, I'm no Usain Bolt, but you know, I can jog. I walk at a brisk pace to class every day, so I stay somewhat in shape. But man, I eat way too many cookies. So I don't know. My center of gravity kind of shifted since freshman year. So Melissa, I had a question for you before I get figured brains about TCU. What's it like being a Sacramento Kings fan?
Those old toys? I know, right? You know those toys where you had and you could like stick your hand in it and all the needles kind of formed around your hand and it left this like impression, but it didn't really hurt because the needles weren't sharp? You know what I'm talking about?
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like having one of those, except all the needles have been sharpened. You press it into your face, the impression stays forever, and you just bleed slowly for long periods of time. That is being a Sacramento Kings fan. And to this day, if you bring up the Western Conference Finals and that Bob
when
Horry
Kobe
shot.
When Kobe hits the buzzer beater?
No, not even that one. It's the Bob Horry one. It's Vlade Divac who was smoking a cigarette, trying to rebound, hit the ball back out to Bob. I can still see it right in this moment from the top of the arc. He nails that three in game six, the Tim Donaghy game. I still get emotional talking about that. So that's what it's like being a Sacramento Kings fan. It's
the new arena, silver lining. I picture the Kings as like the land of misfit toys with DeMarcus Cousins.
He's a big toy,
like,
though.
I really do. I pour one out for all the Kings fans out there. It's been a painful run. I would say I wish you guys luck, but not really. I'm sorry, you guys are just not the most likable franchise.
No, I agree.
But hey, you know what? You know, you can root for Boogie when he goes to a different team, right?
I just want him to escape so he has a shot at success in life, because that's not good.
Yeah.
That's a toxic environment for him to be in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, thanks for doing that. That was cool.
Yeah, well, hey. Yeah, no problem. All right, so on to the TCU questions. So as you guys know, I'm a huge, huge Jarison Stewart fan. I've been on the hype train since he performed against Texas Tech. If you guys go watch the tape, the dude just kind of like played out of his mind as a freshman. So who do you guys think is going to be the leading receiver this year since we lost our Lord and Savior, Josh Dotson?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I think we can start answering that question, Mason, by talking about the TCU depth chart that was just released for South Dakota State about 20 minutes ago. And I'm going to say that it's pretty straightforward. The wide receivers at each starting position listed at the top of each little category here, Taj Williams, Kevontae Turpin, Ty Slanina, and Emmanuel Porter. I think it's going to be one of those four, regardless of who else sees the field this year. I'm going to go personally with Emmanuel Porter. I think that he steps in really well. He's a big physical guy. He's 6'4". He's over 200 pounds. He is fast. Last year at the end of the season when he was filling in for Dotson, you really saw his hands flash a little bit, his ability to go up and fight for the ball. And so I like him as kind of that guy that's going to come out and really be the leader of this receiving core. But it also wouldn't completely shock me if it was Turpin or if it was Taj Williams. But my pick's going to be Emmanuel Porter.
Okay. It's a respectful pick. I'm still riding the J train. I think he's gonna emerge this year. Just watching him in the Alamo Bowl and against Texas Tech and in the Baylor game too, he had the first touchdown pass reception. And I mean, like, the dude's got a solid head of hair too. Like, you know, when he steps on the, you know, the field, it's like he's just dripping with swag, and just like, I wish I was as cool as him sometimes. But yeah, so I'm riding with Jarrison on this pick. All right, so now I asked Melissa about her Kings. Jamie, I got to ask you about the Rangers. Please talk me out of getting on the Rangers World Series hype train right now, because the way that Jonathan Lucroy is playing, Ian Desmond, who I'm getting my first child after, tell me that they're not going all the way to the ship.
They're
Carlos
going all the
Gomez,
way to the ship.
Man.
Carlos Gomez.
Obviously, the home run in his first at-bat.
The Astros were just misusing and abusing him, because he comes in his first at-bat and just ropes a three-run home run upfield.
Wait, Jamie, are you telling me that someone underperformed in the city of Houston? I've never heard of that before.
That's shocking. That's totally shocking.
I mean,
ever since
Darvish,
the Rockets
won okay.
in 1995, they have just been a wealth of underperformance and below average talent in all three sports, all three major sports that they have there. All right, so I think that the Rangers are the obvious front runner in the American League. They beat the Cleveland Indians tonight, who I think are another one of those teams up near the top of the league. Record-wise, I know that they're leading the Central Division by a few games. But I really love the front end of the Rangers rotation with Darvish and Hamels. I think that someone, just one other arm, has to pull it together when it comes to playoff time. And whether that's Perez or A.J. Griffin, or if Holland is healthy by that point, I know he started yesterday. Just one of those guys, if they can get right well enough to give us like 5 or 6 innings in a game three, I think that the bats and the bullpen, especially the back few guys, the 7th, 8th, 9th inning guys, will really, I just think it makes the Rangers a really big threat. But
yeah,
they're also the Texas Rangers, and we should know to never get our hopes up that high, because
yep,
they will inevitably be crushed. So,
yep,
you know, there's
it,
where
it
I
happens.
Stand. There's yep, where I stand.
I mean, and,
it would
and
be the Rangers.
Colby Lewis
luck,
is coming back.
He is.
Yeah.
And he'll be rested, so his 900-year-old yep body should be able to throw for about 55 to 60 more innings before it falls apart again. It would be the Rangers' luck, though, I think, to get to the World Series again and then lose to the Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of luck that Rangers baseball has, I think.
I mean, like, all respect to Jake Arrieta, but, you know, I don't know. I think if Strasburg is healthy, because he just went on the DL, that the Nationals are going to go really deep into the NL this year. Even though the Nationals always joke, and I'll probably eat my words for saying this, but I think they're going to be in the NLCS against the Cubs. But then again, it's an even year, and even though the Giants aren't doing well, it's August, and you know they like to lull us into a false sense of security. But all right, but here, Jamie, let me paint you a picture. Let me paint you a picture real quick. It is Game 5 of the game seven of the ALCS. Toronto versus the Rangers. Ian Desmond's up to bat. 2 outs, 2 on. Rangers down by 3. He hits the walk off home run. He flips his bat and he just mean mugs Jose Bautista as he trots the base pass. Base pass. Do you or do you not get a full mural tattoo on your back like I am?
Of Ian Desmond or of
yes,
just that moment? See, I like
of
Ian Desmond
team,
a lot.
The entire moment.
I like Ian Desmond a lot. If I'm ranking the Texas Rangers players in order of who would grace my body with their tattooed face, I think the first and foremost is going to be Adrian Beltre.
That's fair. He is the captain.
So, you know, he's going to be the first guy that gets a tattoo of himself on my body when it comes to the Rangers. Second, it's going to be Nolan. Third, it's going to be Rusty Greer. Fourth, it's going to be Pudge. Fifth, it's going to be Will Clark. And then we start getting back into some other Rangers that are still on the roster. You know, we've got Odor on that list. We've got Elvis on that list. I would put LaCroix above Desmond right now on that list.
Okay.
Desmond would be a top 10.
That's a bold move. Because I don't think I squealed more than when he hit the go-ahead home run against Toronto in the 7th inning when Odor punched Batista.
Like, I mean, no doubt. It was a magical moment.
But so back to the TCU questions. So I don't know if you guys have already been asked this question, but what team are you scared of the most this season? For me personally, it's Texas Tech, and I feel like I've said that plenty of times in the writings, but Patrick Mahomes is, I think, going to be the best quarterback in the conference this year. He's an incredibly gifted athlete. And even though they kind of had some question marks at receivers, it's a Texas Tech offense. They're going to be fine. And the defense, there's no way it's going to be as bad as it was last year. So I'm not looking forward to that matchup in Fort Worth, but I know I'm going to have a heart attack during the Oklahoma game as well.
I mean, for me, I feel like the Oklahoma is you know, probably the best game on the schedule. I'm not necessarily afraid of it because I think if things play out the way we expect them to, the expectations won't be high. I think it's going to feel a lot like it did two seasons ago when they rolled in as the number five team in the country and TCU was either unranked or hovering somewhere towards the bottom of the rankings. Nobody gave us a shot in that game. I woke up that morning and I kid you not, I was in the shower and I went, huh, we're going to win today. And I got to the tailgate and I started telling people, we're going to win today. Nobody believed me. Everybody thought I was crazy, but I was so confident. And thankfully, I was right. And that's I jumped that wall and rushed that field along with everybody else half my age, and it was a blast. So my expectations for that are while they'll be the best game, the one I'm probably the most looking forward to early, you know, I'm not going to be afraid of that one. Texas Tech is a great one. Going to Morgantown in October, that has me a little bit on edge. That's the game I wouldn't want to lose the most. Because it's one of those that I just don't think you can recover from. Whereas, you know, maybe dropping a game to a Texas Tech team that finishes, you know, 7-2 in the Big 12 or something, it may not knock us down too much. Arkansas is kind of the first one that has me, you know, choking back vomit a little bit early. I think we're the better team, but those SEC fans travel in droves, and we are doing a whiteout for some unknown reason. So it's going to be hard to distinguish who's wearing what out there that day. But that's the first real test we'll have had since, you know, last season, and I'm anxious to see what that team looks like against an SEC opponent.
Yeah, Melissa, I'm with you. There are a couple games there that are really kind of catch my attention and make my stomach do a little bit of a turn. Honestly, though, Arkansas is not one of them. I think that for non-conference games like this, Gary Patterson, just especially when it's so early in the season, he has such a great way of being almost over-prepared and really having his guys everywhere that they need to be, mentally, physically, emotionally, to go out and get a win. So, you know, Arkansas, and just having followed that program as closely as I have over the years, I don't know that they're in a position to be very good early in the season, which has kind of been their trend lately, just because they are also replacing so much on offense that I don't know that they're going to be clicking 100% by that point in the season either. And that's advantage TCU in my mind. Games that do concern me, though, Texas Tech, absolutely. I think you're right, Mason, with Patrick Mahomes. I mean, he's a special kid, and that offense should be stacked again this year. That defense, though, they lost two starting cornerbacks from last year that have transferred. They lost a couple key other guys on defense to graduation. I think they lost some kids to suspension. And so there have just been so many losses on that side of the ball that I don't know if even Texas Tech's offense would be capable of keeping up, especially if TCU's offense is as good as we expect it to be at that point in the season. I mean, that's going to be the middle of October. And by that point, TCU, we're going to be expecting Kenny Hill and all of these kids to be clicking on all cylinders. And so if that's the case, I think that it's another shootout like last year, but TCU comes out on top. The game that always is going to scare me, always, 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 is Baylor. I know that all of this stuff has happened, and I know that they're without Art Briles, and I know that they're without Jared Stidham, and without Corey Coleman, and without Chafin, and all of these kids. But there's just something in the back of my mind that makes me do a double take at November 5th when Baylor is on the schedule. And that's, you know, it's one of those situations where we're going back down to Waco, and we don't want what happened the last time TCU was in Waco to happen again. Baylor is going to want redemption for 2015's game. They're going to want to make a statement to the country. Lord knows what will have happened in their season at that point. It's a rivalry game, so all bets are off. Just that is the game that really kind of scares me more than Oklahoma in Fort Worth, because like Melissa said, you know, that is a game that is winnable because TCU is going to be up for that game. It should be a phenomenal game, but it's the Baylor game. There are so many question marks around that team and that program to go down into Waco and to just come away with a win and not have to worry about it. I don't think that's a feasible thought. So Baylor is the one that scares me the most at this point.
All right. So do you guys got any questions for me and my beautiful mind?
Your beautiful mind. So give me your rankings then as far as who you think would – like give me your top five Frogs of War staffers that would do the best in this 100-yard run as far as time.
Okay, so in the Frogs of War Olympics? Okay.
Yeah.
I think number one I think is going to be Hawkeye. I think just he's in Australia. You know, the atmosphere is thicker there, like in Denver. I think he's got, like, lungs of steel because I have no stamina whatsoever. I can barely crawl to the fridge without just gasping for air. I'll put myself humbly at second. Third, I'll go with Marshall. I think that dude, I think he's probably – he might not have the longest strides, but I think he can sprint like Justin Gatlin. I'll go Scott. I think he gets enough energy from his beard, his gorgeous beard. So I'm gonna put him at the 4 seed. And five, I'll put Jamie. There you go, Jamie. I'll put you there at 5.
Oh, thanks. Two off the
middle. Wow, again. All that work I've been doing at the track really paying off. So
I will say this, you know, Hawk is pretty old, so I don't know that he would have the stamina to make it all the way down the length of a football field either. I would like to think that since I'm 6'3" and I have really long legs, that my stride would at least push me into the top four. But, you know, who really knows? Who really knows?
Have you had any ACL, MCL surgeries?
No, I have not.
Okay. Then, yeah, you could take gold. You could take gold. I mean, I don't know, but, you know, we'll find out.
There's only one way we're
going
to find out.
Yeah.
There's only one way we're going to find out, and it's if we actually do it. And so we're going to need to make
Tokyo.
That happen.
Tokyo 2020. I'll see you guys there.
Absolutely. All right, Mason. Thanks, bud, for hopping on with us.
Oh, I appreciate it, guys. All right, you have a good one.
You too. All right. So we have just a couple minutes left, Melissa. Like I mentioned earlier, the depth chart did come out about half an hour ago now, and I do want to read a couple things off to you and get just some quick hits on what you think. So let's spend maybe 20 seconds on each of these things. First of all, along the defensive line, the starters for South Dakota State will be Josh Caraway, Aaron Curry, Joseph Broadnax, and James McFarland. What do you think about that?
It's a big line. It's a pretty experienced line. And Joseph Broadnax has been one of the most pleasantly talked about guys in the last couple months by Gary Patterson. So I think that's a great sign for TCU.
Yeah, and, you know, one other interesting note about defensive tackle is Ross Blacklock is listed at a third behind Aaron Curry and Chris Bradley at that alternate spot besides Broadnax. So that's something that's really interesting. Let's see. Like I mentioned earlier, wide receivers starters are Taj Williams, Kevontae Turpin, Ty Slanina, and Emmanuel Porter. Any surprises there for you?
None really to me, other than maybe seeing Gray behind Turpin. But I think this is a unit where a lot of guys are going to get on the field and be constantly rotating to keep fresh legs. All I have to say is if I'm an opposing cornerback or an opposing linebacker, I am not happy about the amount of speed TCU's putting out there on every snap.
Excellent. I definitely agree with you there. And then the last two that I wanted to hit, we're talking about secondary overall. You've got Denzel Johnson at strong safety, Nico Small getting the start at free safety, Nick Orr at weak safety, Ranthony Tejada at corner, and then across from him at the other corner is Jeff Gladney. What do you think about that?
Gladney is going to be interesting. I mean, he's an untested, really, really young guy, but all the talent in the world, another Gary Patterson favorite. Nico Small just is going to be a playmaker. I have a feeling this kid's going to be a playmaker. I think he's the kind of guy that's going to get his hands on a lot of footballs, break up a lot of passes, cause some interceptions, and forcing turnovers was, I think, what was really missing from the 2015 version of TCU defense compared to 2014. this is a really exciting group of athletic, rangy kind of players that can make some noise in the secondary and will have plenty of opportunity to prove their worth. I'm excited about this group.
I definitely am too. And that will do it for the Frogs of War Live podcast. I'm Jamie. She's Melissa. Y'all have a good night. Well, that worked out.
Yeah, that was a nice end there. Mm. Way to close that out, the buzzer.
Stuck the landing.
Yeah, you did. 10 out of 10.
All right. Have a good night, and we'll chat tomorrow, okay?
All right, sounds good. Talk to you later, bud.
All right, bye.